title to that land. He just keeps it, and the village himself has to select outside of the village selection area for that same acreage.
All right, those are two possibilities which could occur. Let me just comment on them. As to the latter, where the village corporation could select other land, you're right. The village corporation is given a certain amount of acreage to select, and like within a core township, they have to select all their lands within a core township. If an allotment falls within that area, then they get credit for 160 acres or however large the allotment is that they can select outside that area, so they'll still get their full entitlement. As to swapping with the allotment applicant, that is certainly possible, and it's generally up to the allottee, and since it's trust property, BIA. But in many cases, unless it's done through the BIA and done properly, that allotment could lose its trust status, which is very important. It's the trust status. So if you are considering that, do work through BIA on that. There are provisions in the law that will permit a conveyance of that type. I think there's some monetary considerations to be dealt with too.
Yes.
I think it's a conveyance of funds which are put into trust and then used to purchase other trust property, I believe.
I just used that as an example because that has come up quite a lot of these native allotments, especially between two people. Like if a person has already had his title to that native allotment, and somebody has been living there for quite a while, the BLM or the BIA's theory is that, hey, let's move this guy over here and give him the same title. And that is wrong. Because there is a couple of instances, I can name one right now, is Bud Helmrich's, where his camp is. Now, he is on a person's native allotment and has been there for over 30 years. But it's somebody else's native allotment. He's got the deed to it. Now the BIA wants the person that owns the native allotment to move over. Or it had been suggested to him that he does move over. That's discriminatory.
It really is, and that gets back to my point that a lot of people who are doing some of the implementation of the act, such as the field examiners for BLM and some of the field service people for BIA, do not understand the act and what their actions actually turn out to be. You're right, you can't jump an allotment around like that once the person has applied for specific land. What they're trying to do is resolve conflicts. And unfortunately, the way it usually ends up is, although everyone has good intentions, the allottee stands a real good chance of losing his or her land. Say they applied for, I believe the instance you're talking about, it's on an island right offshore, correct? And the allottee applied for that land, and then he changes it later on to apply for other land. Well, if that ever gets into court, that change in location will not stand, because the only way you can amend your claim is if your application does not describe the land you originally intended to apply for.
Well, see, what I'm saying is it's not the change. The BLM had given that native allotment. It was just in the fact that the person that lived here for 30 years didn't know it was on a native allotment. Nobody ever told him it was on a native allotment.
Probably he didn't know he was on a native allotment until 1971, when people began to learn about what a native allotment is. And you're right, that is another problem.
I mean, that's...
But for homesteads, again, homesteads, part of filling out a homestead application is you cannot be on native land, native use land.
Can I ask you a question about that? We're not allowing you to proceed in an orderly way.
That's okay. As I look through here, I think I've proceeded.
Well, no, I want you, when we've stopped harassing you, I want you to return to your and proceed as you intended. But could you just say a word about the relationship between homesteading and allotments? Were Alaska Natives excluded from homesteading in the early days? What's the relationship between allotments and homesteads?
I think they were excluded initially from homesteading because they were not deemed citizens or people under the homestead acts generally. In fact, that is why they did pass, first of all, the general Indian Allotment Act, which is applicable to the lower 48. There was also a question as to whether or not that applied here in Alaska. So to resolve that, they passed the 1906 Alaska Native Allotment Act. It was viewed, and it's referred to in a lot of the early documents, as the Indian Homestead Act. The
1906
Act. The 1906 Act, correct.
Just going, you've triggered something else.
Okay.
The Allotment Act in the lower 48 for Indians was the Dawes Act.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And the idea was to break up reservations by parceling them out among the Indians as individuals, then taking what was left over and giving it or selling it to the settlers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way of destroying Indian tribes. And you say that nobody was sure whether Indians in Alaska or Eskimos in Alaska could apply under the Dawes Act.
There were questions as to that, right?
So that's why they passed the 1906 Act. But of course, there were no reservations here to break up in those days.
Right.
Except conceivably for Metlakatla, and I forget the. Did they have any conceptual problems about all that? Is there any legislative history that indicates that what they were trying to do? Did they think, well, we let the Indians in the lower 48 apply for allotments out of reservation land?
Mm-hmm.
And there are no reservations in Alaska, so we'll let Alaska Natives apply out of the whole thing, provided they can show they were making use of it.
Right. Some of the historical research I've done, say in association with cases, indicates.
That's one. The Act of March 3, 1891, which changed the General Allotment Act to the Native Allotment Act. But it was called the Miners and Merchants. I don't remember exactly what it is. It from a general allotment, which was a the Americans could make a general allotment, apply for a general allotment, and they could get subservice rights. Under 3391, the state was able to go ahead and give a fee simple title under that act. In other words, the state was given authority to give us, the natives here in Alaska, 160 acres, which became that 1906 Act. When I was reviewing and also investigating exactly how our native allotments were, they always had one simple deal where it always kills itself. It's that valid existing rights may not be subject to these native allotments. I think you should look into the March 3, 1891 Act.
Could I?
Which is very, very, yeah. It's simple, and it shows you how to do it, but in there is the provisions with it.
Yeah. Could I raise another matter, Mr. Florent?
Mm-hmm.
That is, under the Dawes Act of 1887, the General Allotment Act,
uh-huh.
designed to break up Indian reservations and parcel them out among individual Indians through allotments, they were to be held in trust by the federal government for 25 years, but then the Indians would get fee simple title and could sell them. And that's how they lost about half of the Indian land in the lower 48.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the 1906 Act came up, there was no provision for the trust arrangement ending. In other words, those allotments are still held in trust by the government of the United States, by the Secretary of the Interior.
Right.
Was there any, was anybody thinking very hard about that, or had they decided that they they had made a mess of the Dawes Act by the time 1906 rolled around?
My research, as I think back on it, is somewhat sketchy, but I think I do recall mention of those problems in discussions of prior to the passage of the 1906 Act. There certainly is a provision where allottees can apply to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to remove their land from trust status. BIA's determination would be whether or not they feel the individual applicant is competent enough to handle their own affairs. But there was some reflection on the Dawes Act during the passage or discussions prior to the passage of the Native Allotment Act. Regarding your question as to the purpose in the lower 48 was to break up the tribes, and there are no tribes here in Alaska, there seems to be, my historical research seemed to indicate, again, that paternalism. And they acknowledge the fact that Alaska Natives were nomadic to a certain extent, just leaving their things behind. Like they were amazed that Indians or Eskimos didn't lock up their houses when they left their fish camp, and it was just, you know, open, real comfortable, I guess. So they viewed this Allotment Act as a way of protecting these innocent people from the invasions of whites. Again, that's not to say that they also had the motive of pinning them down to certain tracts of land, but I think at that time Alaska was not viewed as anything. Well, I take that back. They did have the gold rush. So they may have had an ulterior motive of pinning people down so that they could decide other land status in the area.
Yeah. You said that until statehood, there had been perhaps less than 100 applications for allotments, and virtually all of them in southeast Alaska. Had any of those people, as far as you know, ever applied to the secretary to be released for cancellation of the trust and to allow them to sell?
I do know of instances, I'm not sure if it's in the southeast, I do know of instances where people have applied. In fact, some of them are right outside Anchorage. Part of the reason for doing it is, for understandable reasons, some people just don't trust BIA, and it takes quite a while for that to be real. For instance, if an allottee wanted to do something profitable with their lands, it has to go through BIA if it's still in trust status, and that could virtually take forever to get that type of permission. So what they prefer to do is remove it from trust status and then deal with these people, with whomever they want to deal with on their own. So it has been done. In the southeast, I'm sure there are individuals who, once they receive their allotment, will apply to have it unrestricted, to receive it unrestricted.
Well, you brought us as far as statehood, I think. And
okay, I think I'm somewhere in the late 60s.
Well, don't skip anything.
No, I'm...
You only took me as far as 1959.
Okay, well, between 1906 and the mid-1960s, there was very little known about the Native Allotment Act, very few applications filed. Then in the late 60s, when there was talk of the Claims Act settlement, people began to realize that, well, one thing that they're going to include in the Claims Act is a repeal of the Native Allotment Act. So BIA got together with Rural Cap, and they took on a couple of VISTA volunteers, and they went across the state getting allottees to sign up for their land. They picked up somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 applications. I mean, it was a tremendous push, relatively successful, I guess, in light of the past performances. So they had thousands of applications. They couldn't process them all, so they sent these applications down to California, and I believe it was Sacramento, for some additional processing. Just to give you an idea of that process, which again has turned up problems now, is when they filled out an application, if a Rural Cap worker or a BIA person went to a village, they'd have a map with them and some tracing paper. So again, they assumed that Alaska Natives could identify their land from a map, which is kind of bizarre. But so they had them trace their land out on this tracing paper, and they attached that to the application, sent it down to California, where that legal description was then placed on the application and then sent back up to Alaska. That has caused a lot of problems as to the locations of claims. Then AXA came along and...
Sure. I just missed that. The elders want to come down here and they want to know if you're going to still be here tonight. I think you are,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Yeah, so Eileen, we can tell them Mr. Florent will be here tonight. I missed what you were saying just before you got to AXA. Forgive me.
Sure. What I have been saying is when people were aware that the Claims Act was pending, part of it was going to include the repeal of the Allotment Act, BIA got together with RuralCap and canvassed the state seeking applications, and they picked up between 7,000 or 8,000, I believe. That was too much for BLM and BIA to process up here in Anchorage, so some of them were shipped off to California, and I believe it was Sacramento or San Francisco, for processing and then sent back up. Excuse me. Part of the processing was when a RuralCap or BIA person went out to a village to get applications, they had USGS maps with them. And to identify lands, they would take tracings on trace paper or just general descriptions done on a white sheet of paper. These were sent down to California, where these people were supposed to get the legal aliquot parts descriptions, township and range type thing, and then sent back up to Alaska for the adjudication or review process of that application. Well, that has caused a lot of problems, as I'll note later, in locating the original intent, and that is a major problem today. Well, then came the Claims Act, and Section 18A of the Claims Act repealed the Native Allotment Act with a savings clause. What that means is all Native Allotment applications which were filed before the repeal, before December 18th, 1971, were still good. But after December 18th, you couldn't file anymore. That was it. Part of their reasoning in including the 14C reconveyance to Alaska Natives was the fact that they repealed the act. It's like, well, we're taking the Allotment Act away from you, but here's another way that you can acquire title to your subsistence areas. And of course, that removed it from trust status because of 14C reconveyance is not trust property. It's also generally smaller acreage, although that's not, I believe it's not specified in the act. It's just that most village corporations could not afford to give out 160-acre tracts of land to their villages.
The regional corporations at the time that had approval from the victory or any tribal government body to select on.
The regional corporations?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. The whole problem, as I researched the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, for that, the Artichoke Hill Regional Corporations did not have any lands. They had to get it from the Inuit Community of the Arctic Slope, which is a tribal government. But they must have had to have consent of its people to select those lands. But it was done internally because the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation Board of Directors were the same people at that time selected and appointed as the tribal government. In other words, the Inuit Community of the Arctic Slope. They did it internally without the consent of its people. This is where all the problems of our lands have been going on. We have looked into it. We've asked the United States, the solicitor, to make an opinion on it. And we have gotten nowhere. We have gone this far only that we have seen that our tribal government's land were given away without the consent of its people. And it still stands because the valid existing right, all townships, all conveyances are subject to that valid existing right of its people. They must have consent.
Can I just raise another question, Mr. Florent? There was an Alaska Native Townsite Act, and under that act, Native people received restricted deeds to home sites within the towns and villages, didn't they?
Yes.
Could you just enlarge on that and its relationship to allotments?
I'm not as, again, familiar with that. However, my exposure to it has been more in a sense of confusion amongst the applicants. When you talk to them about their allotment claim, they at times confuse their town site claim because, again, to them it's their land, and the land runs through regardless of whatever they were applying for, be it town site allotment or this Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Then there are those who did understand that the Town Site Act and their trust property just meant where their home was and was within the town site itself, and so they did not use a selection under their Allotment Act rights to select that land again. They took their full 160 acres and selected outside the town site. There aren't too many allotment claims that are located right in the middle of a village. Most people did select the hunting or subsistence areas. Outside of that, I don't see too much of a connection between the two. We haven't run into too much of a conflict between them, except for the fact that some people are confused over the two.
And both acts were repealed with the passage of ANCSA, as I recall, were they not? Or was the Townsite Act in force till 76?
It may have been enforced until 76. I don't know if it was affected by the Claims Act at all.
And we will be at 2. Okay. Well, Eileen has suggested we stop for lunch. The reason is that we haven't been on the radio this morning, but at 2 o'clock apparently they are going to put us on the radio, and so if we come back at 2, maybe Mr. Florent could kind of start over again and give his presentation, and it'll go out over the radio and might be of help to other people. And but I think this has been a good discussion, and I think these questions have been very good. I've learned a lot, and we'll maybe give Mr. Florent a clear run at things this afternoon. So would it be all right if we stop then until 2 o'clock?
Can I make one comment?
Yeah, please do.
Adjourn for our this morning session. Concerning town sites, we had comprehensive public hearings at Nooksit. Because according to the ANCSA Act, the Village Corporation cannot get land until they convey the town site to the village of Nooksit. And for the record, the village of Nooksit was the first village in the North Slope area to reach agreement with the village of Nooksit, with Kuktik Corporation, and with the North Slope Borough, which the borough mayor, Eugene Bauer, has signed recently, because I was a council member when We had the meetings between Cookie Corporation, between the city of Nooksack and the North Slope Borough, because there were conflicts of interest. The main conflict that we had with the British Corporation was they didn't want to appropriate the full 1,620 acres to the village. So we had to negotiate, and we had to select certain tracts of land, and we have done that, and all parties have signed it.
And how much land is the village, the city government of the village getting?
We negotiated with the attorneys for the British Corporation, and we got the full 1,620 acres.
Well, thank you, and I hope you'll be back this afternoon, and we'll start again at 2 o'clock. I guess we should if we hooked up all the rest of it.
All they have to do is press the switch. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Begin. Well, we'll resume this afternoon session of the Alaska Native Review Commission. We're holding this meeting at the North Slope Borough Assembly Room, and we have with us David Fleurant of Alaska Legal Services, who is talking about native allotments. And this morning, he answered questions about allotments. This afternoon, he's going to talk for a while about the Allotment Act, and then people can ask him questions. And we expect that he will be with us again this evening, too. So we are glad that he's here. We will also be available here this afternoon and this evening for anybody who wants to come and participate and to give their views about ANCSA. We're just we're going to be here this afternoon and this evening so that people can come down and talk about land claims and 1991 and all the other issues we've been discussing. Right, well, do you want to begin again?
I can certainly start over. As Justice Berger had indicated, my name is Dave Fleurant, and I'm the Native Allotment Coordinator for Alaska Legal Services in Anchorage. Alaska Legal Services receives some money from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to assist Native Allotment applicants in getting their land. I've been asked to speak here because there seems to be some confusion as to the relationship between the Native Allotment Act and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. From my own observations and sitting in on some of these hearings, I'm beginning to get a clearer picture of where this confusion might lie. And hopefully by the end of this program, I will have answered more questions than I have raised. I'll start now with a brief history of the Native Allotment Act. It was passed by the U.S. government in 1906. The purpose for signing the act or creating the act was to create a way for Alaskan Natives to acquire title to land that they had used and occupied. At the turn of the century, as you all know, gold was discovered in Alaska in several areas, and that caused a lot of white settlers to come up from the lower 48. When they saw some land that they liked, they would file a homestead application on it. If it happened to have been land that was used and occupied by an Alaskan Native, they would generally just run the Native off his own land and apply with a homestead application because there was no way for Alaskan Natives to apply for that land. So in 1906, Congress passed the Alaska Native Allotment Act. Some of the basic requirements for applying for an allotment were that the land had to be vacant, unappropriated, and unreserved at the time you first entered the land. Essentially, this means that the land had to be free from the claims of others. It means that the federal government did not set aside that land for a particular purpose. It means that there weren't any other claims on that land, say by a white settler or by another Alaskan native. Another requirement was that the allotment could not exceed 160 acres. It could encompass up to four separate parcels of land, but the total of those parcels could not exceed 160 acres. The land had to be non-mineral in character, which means that if there was gold or platinum or anything like that, silver, on your land, you would not get it. If there was oil, gas, or coal underneath your land, you could still get that land as your allotment, but the federal government would reserve the right to come in and take the oil, gas, or coal underneath your land, but you would be compensated for any disturbance of your surface estate, the land that you occupied. There is a recent change as of 1980, since we're talking about mineral and non-minerals, was prior to 1980, the Bureau of Land Management had considered sand and gravel as a mineral. With the passage of ANILCA, the D2 Lands Bill, the federal government said that sand and gravel is not a mineral. Whether or not this is retroactive in application is yet to be seen. Of course, we interpret it that it is retroactive. Another requirement of the Native Allotment Act was that you had to be of full or mixed blood, Native Alaskan blood. There seems to be no specific limitation as to the mixture. A requirement as to your use was that your use and occupancy had to be substantially continuous for a period of 5 years. What this means is that even if it's just on a seasonal basis, as for say a fish camp or for a hunting camp, you had to have used that area on something more than a sporadic or occasional basis, and you had to have done it for at least 5 years. And the last requirement that I'll discuss is that the regulations require that your use of the land be at least potentially exclusive of others. That does not mean that you had to keep everyone else off your land, but more that you used your land as would any landowner use his or her land, and that others in the area recognize that land as yours. Well, between the passage of the act in 1906 and down through till the mid-1960s, there were very few applications filed. Those applications that were filed were mostly in the southeast. The reason for the low number of applications was that no one was telling the Alaskan Natives about the act. There were several applications in the southeast, as I had mentioned, and that was due to the fact that there was a BIA office in Juneau or Sitka, but there wasn't one up here on the North Slope, nor was there a BIA office in most of the hub villages now. So there was no way of conveying to Alaskan Natives that, one, they had an opportunity to apply for the land, two, there was no opportunity for them to obtain forms to apply for the land themselves, and three, there was no one to help them fill out those forms to apply for the land. In the late 1960s, there was the discussions about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act started becoming more common. Part of these discussions included a repeal of the Alaska Native Allotment Act. When BIA realized that they were going to repeal the Allotment Act when they passed the Claims Act, they began a sign-up drive throughout the state. What they did was they traveled to as many villages as possible, told people about the Allotment Act, gave them the forms to apply for an allotment, and helped them fill out the forms. As a result of this drive, BIA and RuralCap acquired several thousand new applications for Native allotments. ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, was then passed in December of 1971. Section 18A of that act repealed the Allotment Act with a savings clause, which provided that all Native allotment applications that were pending before the department on that date were still good applications, but no one else could file after that date. You couldn't get an allotment anymore. Within ANCSA is a provision, and most of you are probably aware of it, for the 14C reconveyances from the village corporations. It is my understanding that that provision was put in there to compensate for the repeal of the Allotment Act. They viewed the 14C provision as a way of conveying title to subsistence areas to the Alaska Natives. Part of the confusion between ANCSA and Native allotments is many people think that their allotments will be affected in 1991. That is not correct. The land will, if you receive your Native allotment certificate, if you are approved and you get your land, 1991 will not affect you. It will still be trust status. It will still be yours. It is not village corporation land. It is not regional corporation land. It is your land.
We'll just take the mic over there.
Do I have to state my name?
Sure.
Okay. I'm Mary Edwardson. I own two allotments, 80 acres each. So what about by 1991, will they be taxable?
No.
By the North Slope Borough or whatever government we have, will they be taxable by then?
No. 1991 will not affect the trust status of your Native allotment claim.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do now is briefly discuss the review, or what BLM terms the adjudication process, that goes on with your application. Many of you have submitted your application and you don't hear anything else until maybe someone from Legal Services comes up to you and asks you to sign another paper, or you get a letter from BLM and it just tells you that your application is still being worked on. So I'd like to just go through some of that so you'll have a better understanding of what happens to your application. Most of you have filed it with BIA. Once BIA receives your application, they give it to BLM. as part of your application, or as part of the review process, BLM will generally send out some people to do a field examination of your claims. Now, I've been told that there's been some confusion between a field exam and a survey. The field exam is where someone from BLM goes out to your land, and they should take you along or one of your appointed representatives, and they look on your land for evidence of use and occupancy. They look to see if the resources are there for the uses you claim. For example, if you use your land for berry picking, they look at the land to see if there are berries on it, or if you use it for fishing, that you can fish from your land. A survey is something that takes place later on, where they measure out the boundaries for your land. It's a much more technical review. It's not really a review of your claim. It just sets the boundaries for your land. So that's what the survey is, and the two aren't really related, although in the field exam, they will mark the corners of your claim so that the surveyors know where to go. So a field exam will be conducted on the land. The field examiner will write up a report and submit it to BLM.
Eileen?
Yeah. If this is being translated? Grab the mic, yeah.
Just wait a moment till we get the translation fixed up, and then we'll let you.
Tom, Eileen needs to be able to translate, and so she has to have people speak to one of these mics. So if we can have people come to the table if they have a question, that's the only way
that
she can.
That one doesn't work.
We've got two different sets of mics. One set of mic goes into the system. One set of mic goes into the translator. So they have to talk into both mics at the same time.
So
if someone has a question, can we put the mic over here on this?
Okay.
Or I'm sorry, it's a little inconvenient, but Eileen can't hear to translate unless we have people come up here. We can put a chair up here.
Chair on the other side there.
Or either side.
Can you give us your name?
Yes, my name is Johnny Gunnar Brower. I'm from here in Barr. I live in Browerville. And since you're on issues of native land claims and native allotments, personally myself, I don't have any native allotments, or I never filed for any. And I am just curious to know if it's still possible to get some native allotments patent down. I myself, I come from a very large family. My parents are Arnold and Emily Brower Sr. And I have 16 brothers and sisters. 15 of them, in 16 including myself, we haven't filed any at all with reasons not being told or educated about those purposes, and I would like to find out if it's possible to get some for my interested family members.
The Native Allotment Act itself was repealed by the Claims Act, so you cannot file for a Native Allotment application now. As I indicated, there's nothing in the Claims Act, other than the fact that it repealed it, that affects native allotments. So it wouldn't be say necessarily an amendment to the Claims Act that you're looking for.
I'm not looking for any land to claim or anything. I have from family status, we have land that we use quite a few times, not just one weekend or for the summer. We have hunting places and picking grounds and other places that we use for resourceful uses of picking certain things and hunting certain things at various times of each year, depending on their migratory patterns and routes at the time they migrate to them, or when the vegetation is available at growth, if it grows during the summer at all.
And that's what the Allotment Act was meant to do, is a way for Alaska Natives to acquire title to those lands which they used on a seasonal basis. But that has been repealed, so you cannot acquire, say, title to those lands under the Native Allotment Act. The only way I know of right now that you could perhaps do it would be under the Claims Act, the 14C reconveyance provisions, where if these lands that you mention are on village corporation lands,
they are in the regional corporation land district.
Well, and that's interesting. I was just discussing that earlier. I'm not sure why regional corporations were not obligated to acknowledge the subsistence areas of their shareholders. I know the village corporations were required. They must convey those 14 C's over. But I'm not aware of any provisions for regional corporations. I might be mistaken, not being totally familiar with the Claims Act.
Then but would I be able to file for some land, or would I, if I file for some, then they would just reject it and just saying, you're a native and you don't need any land?